support comes from Air Camp, a week-long summer camp that introduces middle school students to the wonders of flight and the science, technology, engineering, and math of aviation. Air Camp students explore Dayton's aviation sites, take flight training, and pilot a plane. Applications are accepted at aircampusa.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. When Gerald Shea was a young boy, he lost much of his hearing after a bout with scarlet fever. He became profoundly deaf, but because he had already been speaking and hearing before the illness, he managed to limp along through a top prep school on a scholarship, through Yale, and later through Columbia Law School near the top of his class. He appeared successful, but was unaware of his disability, and inside he did start to feel the stress of the struggle that was costing him relationships and his career. Joining us now from San Francisco is Gerald Shea. Mr. Shea has practiced law internationally for many years as a member of the New York and Paris bars. He lives in Paris and Massachusetts. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you, Ann. It's nice to be here.
So there are three literary excerpts at the front of your book, just before the contents page, one from Beethoven at age 31, another one from a French writer, Rochambeau, Auguste de Babian, and another one from The Wind in the Willows. After reading your memoir, I think I get the reference to each. Would you talk about their meanings to you?
Talk about their meanings to me?
Yes.
Well, Auguste Babian, the first one, the Frenchman, was probably the founder of deaf education, that is, the education of the profoundly deaf. And his words were magic to me because he stressed how important communication was to everybody and how alone we are without it. And that is one of the principal themes of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Beethoven, when he was becoming profoundly deaf, lamented the fact not so much that he couldn't hear music. Well, he couldn't hear a flute in the distance, but what really troubled him was that he couldn't understand the words that people were saying. He could hear the sounds, but not the words. And Kenneth Graham, of course, in The Wind in the Willows, talks about the beauty of the wind going through the willows, and that is a sound that I rediscovered when I finally got hearing aids at age 34.
A great deal of the book is ambitiously written to include the lyricals that you heard. You call them lyricals. Would you describe what that means to you?
Yes. When I had scarlet fever at 6, the fever, in effect, crippled the cells in the cochlea that hear high-frequency sounds so that I no longer heard consonants. And consonants are the markers of our speech. And when you don't hear them, you hear the vowels, and you have to figure out what people are saying. For example, if you said, I thought of that, I could hear I lost my hat. And I would have to figure out whether you had a hat on when you came in. And meantime, the conversation would get ahead of us, and I would have to catch up. If you take the title of the book, Song Without Words, and just look at the consonants, S, N, G, W, etc., you'll be able to figure them out if I just wrote them down for you. But if you looked at the vowels in the title, all you would have was A-I-O-U-O, an incomprehensible mess. So that's the struggle that many, many partially deaf people go through in life, because it's those high-frequency sounds that go first.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gerald Shea. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. If you have a question or comment for Gerald Shea, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out the Facebook page as well if you want to post your question or comment there. You kept the lyricals to yourself because you thought that everyone heard them like you did. And that's kind of the most amazing part. And I was wondering, as a child, was there for you a distinct before and after? You knew you were sick and you knew when you were well from being sick, but was there a distinct before and after when it came to your hearing?
I think not. And I think that what I call it an invisible curtain that slowly descended on the world. The birds tend to disappear, flocks of them, not loud crows or seagulls. The crickets vanished. The consonants went, the lyricals, the long, the wrong words or the non-words that I hear, slowly came into existence. But as you said earlier, I felt it was so gradual and so almost unnoticeable that I felt that my slowness, the process of translating lyricals, was something that everybody went through, but just that others were much quicker at it than I was. In fact, I'm starting to get mail from other people, emails, who have gone through exactly the same experience. One teacher at Northeastern was hard of hearing without realizing it from childhood and finally got hearing aids at age 40, left the university, and decided to paint.
You also wrote about your saints and angels that you said helped you as a child, finding things, crossing the street at the right times, and so forth. Can you talk a little bit about that? You had a Catholic school, upbringing until you went to Andover.
Well, that's right. In Catholic schools, of course, it was a religious time for me, and one of the comforts I had was of being able simply to hear the voices of my angels and saints as I talked to them in the street or wherever. Entirely comprehensible. John Locke says that we need words to understand each other. Words are the signs of our thoughts. Absolutely right. And without them, we're isolated. But in my case, I was able to understand these angels, find us there, do this now. Your father, who died when I was 6, is all right. Those voices I heard, of course, they were voices probably, no doubt, of my own creation.
When you talked about the buzzing in your ears, you spent a lot of time writing about that. Did that start as soon as you lost your hearing? Did it start when the hearing problem started, or did it come on gradually?
I think that was, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
I think of them as having almost always been with me. They are a noise in the head. I remember in our summer house in Marblehead, that as a young child that I would trace to that first summer after scarlet fever, I used to think it was the sound of dragon files. And in the fall, the sound of, I don't know, falling leaves. They're with me all the time. As Emmanuel Laborie, the French deaf actress, says, I am noise within and silence without. And I think many deaf people are like that, and partially deaf people too, of course. Beethoven said that his ears buzz and ring day and night. And he said also that the only thing that saved him from suicide was his own art, the art of his music.
When you were going through school as a young child, how did you keep up then? Didn't teachers become cross with you sometimes? I mean, I know they will now if a kid asks too many questions. Didn't you listen properly?
I didn't ask a lot of questions.
You didn't
laugh. I did some things. I remember right coming back from scarlet fever to school, the teacher said, get a blah pencil from the Bob Boer. And so I finally figured out, she said, get a pencil. So I went up to the blackboard and got a red pencil. And then she said, no, get a Bobenser. And I figured out that was a black pencil. So I went up and got a black pencil. So there were errors like that. But I was a pretty good student. I could speak well because I'd learned how to speak. I read slowly at first, I think, because words on paper come very quickly compared to spoken words. But I was very concentrated and a good student. There were tough moments. I remember a couple of nuns asked me about a poem I wrote in, I don't know, the fifth grade, something like that. And the discussion became more complicated than the poem itself, and I ended up in tears. So there were moments like that, but I was a good enough student and wise enough not to ask questions but to get it later, and good enough at deciphering my lyricals that I did well.
And the people that you were with the most, your family, never any questions there. Of course, back then, there was no association necessarily with hearing loss and scarlet fever necessarily. They weren't looking for it, but they didn't notice?
No, I don't think so. I think in a family, you get to notice the meter and the voices of the people you love, and it becomes an easier way of communication. There was a lot of laughter in our family. I knew my mother's voice very well. I have three brothers. And they, too, I think I understood pretty well. I remember, though, going to movies as a child. I've never been able to understand movies, and it's very, very difficult because of the distance of the voices and the mechanical nature of the sound, so that my brother would always explain to me what happened in movies. I'd go to a movie and somebody would get mad and some man would kiss a woman, somebody would shoot somebody, and then somebody else would come along and save them. And then the lion would appear, and that would be the end. But I'd have no idea what really happened.
And he just figured, oh, he just doesn't get the movie. He's too young or something like that.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
He thought you just didn't get the movie, the idea of it. It wasn't that he understood that you couldn't hear it.
No, I thought, I'm not sure what I thought. I thought my brother was very smart and very, very able to figure out these complex plots that were so, I guess, so obscure. I thought to perhaps most other people in the movie theater. I saw Lincoln the other day, for example, with my hearing aids. And there's a lot of complex discussion in Lincoln about the constitutional amendment. And I really couldn't follow it, even though I saw the movie in Paris with French subtitles. So it's still very difficult. Rocky is just as difficult for me as Mulholland Drive.
So you still don't enjoy movies that much?
Well, I like them. I do like going to movies, and if the dialogue's not too complicated, I can pick up the French subtitles in Paris. So I never go to French movies because they're incomprehensible, and yet I speak French fluently.
You did get a hearing test in the first grade, but that was a few months before you became ill with scarlet fever, and you were unsure why you never had another test. Looking back, was that just the times that they just didn't test kids hearing that often?
I think that's right. I think the people that are writing to me now have gone through the same experience. There were simply no testing going on, and of course, if you looked as if you could hear well, and nothing seemed to be wrong, you wouldn't be sent off to your hearing doctor. You would just be left to struggle for yourself. But I was not an unhappy child then. I was, mm-hmm. if in conversations, if I didn't follow, I would maybe change the subject or maybe laugh or maybe sing a song or and just try to get along with everybody as best I could. So I was happy, almost as happy after the scarlet fever as before, I think. I just had a different way of communicating.
At Andover, you know, there's always the kind of hazing type of thing where there's a new kid and, you know, how are we going to get along with him? And you described an incident where you were Catholic and there weren't that many Catholics at Andover at the time. And they started playing music from Mass or something from every room to kind of give you a hard time.
Yeah, well, we had a big debate about religion. All those smart Protestant heads, I'm not a practicing Catholic now, but all those mm-hmm. smart Protestant heads wanted to argue with me about Catholic, I won't get into the specifics, but Catholic mm-hmm. religious doctrine. And I didn't do very well. And the next night when I came back, as I got to the first floor, all the radios on the first floor went on, and it was Cardinal Cushing saying
That's
the
right.
rosary. And I got to the second floor, the second floor radios went on, and as I got to the third, they went on too. But I thought it was kind of very amusing myself. I imitated the Cardinal. And as when I started at Andover, I was also playing football. It was easier for me to mix in. It might have been more difficult for a child who had been through that argument and that rosary experience if he had not been an athlete. But I was lucky.
But it was also just part of your personality. You started laughing when you heard it and figured out what they had done.
Well, that's right. I mean, I can imitate the Cardinal myself and how he says, you know, I'm not going to do it here, but I can do it. I can get all those vowels in.
My guest is Gerald Shea. He's the author of a new memoir.
And call me Jerry. I think that okay. In France, I'm Gerald, but,
well,
but
just,
over here in the States, I'm Jerry.
It's just when people look up your name to find your book. But he's the author of a new memoir. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. If you have a question or comment for Jerry, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the TSA's new strategy on airline security. Small knives are okay, and so are trusted passengers. But who makes that list and how? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 28 degrees with some snow showers likely today, and just a light accumulation, a high of 35 degrees. There's a chance of some light snow for tonight, a low of 22. Mostly sunny for Thursday and a high of 40 degrees, and partly sunny and warmer on Friday with a high of 51. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Gerald Shea. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. If you have a question or comment for Jerry, give us a call, 614-292-8513. I want to talk about how you made it through Columbia Law School in a minute. But first, how did you make it through Yale?
Well, Yale is a great place. Once you get in, you can do what you want. I remember my first day in a large class at Yale in a lecture hall. There were 200 or 300 kids there, and the teacher started speaking. And everybody picked up their pens and pencils and started writing, except me. And I thought, God, what a wonderful school this is, or at least what a talented student body, because I had no idea what the teacher was saying. So I did, though, over time, develop the lurking suspicion that I didn't really belong there because there were so many environments in which I couldn't understand. But I managed to make a lot of friends. I'm musical. I can sing those low notes and hear those low notes. In fact, I sang at Yale in the Whiffen Poofs, which is the group of seniors, about 13 or 14 of us. And even with them, I'd have to wait to hear them start to sing. I couldn't hear the pitch pipe, and I simply thought they were more musically talented than I was. I could read, too, so I could get by academically. And in the tough classes, where the words were different, vocabulary was different, like economics, for example, I persuaded the teacher to give me his own special course after each of our three days a week courses at Yale. So there were cases where I was rescued, but Yale for me was not really a rigorous academic experience. It was a musical experience, learning by reading and to some extent by listening and paying attention and in the smaller seminars, and certainly a musical time for me.
Gabrielle in Delaware, you're on the air with Jerry Shea. Welcome to the show, Gabrielle.
Hi, thanks. I think this is so interesting because my daughter at 5 years old, we discovered had hearing loss and really was, for practical purposes, sort of deaf. And since then, luckily, with surgery, she's actually perfectly hearing now. But it took a long time to sort of notice what was happening because you interpret things through experience. So, but someone might think a child could just be focused on their work, as she often was, on her reading, on her painting, and or thinking she just wasn't paying attention. Her preschool didn't even notice. It would sort of seem to phase in and out. And what we discovered was she actually had developed all these coping mechanisms of reading lips and other resourceful things of following visual cues. And it made me think a lot about how also parenting, we should think about these things, because I have a tiny bit of hearing loss just from going to concerts. And apparently, scientifically, if you go to one rock concert, you have a little bit of hearing loss. And so if we think about that, of, as parents, that we can really be paying a little more attention to these things, because it is permanent when it happens usually. And that's something that is, to consider.
Yes, I think that's right. It sounds like you came in not so clear, but you were talking about your daughter who's hard of hearing and had these struggles. I think she has to work through her own lyricals as well in order to get to the words, and it's not an easy task. Lip reading, of course, plays a big role. These lyricals are given to you not just by the vowels that you hear, but also by the movements of lips. But it's awfully difficult to read lips, and there's always a lag between what people say and what you understand them to be saying.
Gabrielle, how did you find out that your daughter was deaf? Was it from a routine hearing screening going into school?
No, it wasn't. Actually, it was that I started sort of snapping at her or yelling at her a little more because she just wasn't seeming to pay attention, or she seemed to be just not listening. And I thought, you know, I felt bad that I was kind of snapping at a five-year-old. And when I would say her name, then she would respond, because at that point it was at a volume she could hear.
Right.
So I then suddenly did a test and just turned her away from me and was speaking at different volumes. And I said, when she heard my voice, to lift her arm. And after a long time, I was getting sort of louder and louder. And then she turned around and said, "Go ahead and speak, Mom."
Oh, wow.
And that was a moment you said, oh.
Is your daughter profoundly deaf, Gabrielle? Is she?
Well, no longer. It turned out through surgery it was fixable. So that was also interesting. If we hadn't caught it, it could have been permanent.
Yeah.
So her
problem was probably a bone problem in the middle ear, I imagine.
Well, I think it also had to do with drainage, which was decaying the bones. But she caught it, and the surgeon said that with the level of swelling, an adult would have been complaining about the pain. But again, a child doesn't have any sense of reference. So
yes, of course.
She's
That's right.
dealing with that. Hmm. But I also feel very sensitive now to the idea of what we do actively to our hearing to protect it or to lose it. And I think that's something else parents can think about, not having to go through the experience I did, you know, beforehand, just because if you pay attention to some of these things, then you start realizing that's such a precious gift to have
that's
hearing.
That's right. And I think the world is much more sensitive to these, to hearing problems today than they were in my time as a child.
Yeah.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for your call.
Thanks.
Take
Bye-bye.
Care. Bye-bye. I just turned down the sound on my headphones, by the way. The volume. I am sensitive to that because I know that sometimes I keep turning it up, just inching it up, and it doesn't need to be as loud as I have it sometimes.
Yep.
So let's get to your coping mechanism at Columbia Law School. It was amazing. You invented a new way of learning for yourself, and that affected how you participated so you can concentrate on something else.
Well, at Columbia Law School, I had great difficulty with the new concepts and thoughts, vocabulary too, putting it together. And finally, I decided to get down to the front of the room. There were quadrants, and I was in the nose of the quadrant, almost right in front of the teacher. And when I could sit toward the front of the room, at the beginning, the S's, the Shays sat in back. And I began to write down everything I heard. I wrote down all those lyricals, and then I would go back to my office. I had an office at the law school. I was working for a prominent legal historian, and after I was through with that work, say starting at 8 or 8:30 at night, I would go back to my notes, reread the case, and translate those lyricals into English. And that method worked very well because I eventually got it, and I wound up being, as you mentioned, very close to the top of the class. But it wasn't a system that was going to work in real life.
Right,
in real life things go by much more quickly.
My guest is Gerald Shea. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. If you have a question or comment for Jerry, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Jerry, I remember studying Chaucer in college and realized, unfortunately, too late in the semester, that if I just read it through as if in sort of a stream of consciousness, I could understand that almost familiar language of Middle English. And you reminded me of that when you wondered whether the summer you spent studying those 18th century newspapers on microfilm might have helped you understand the obscure words.
Well, yes, that's right. That's right. looking at those, reading those microfilms and deciphering, figuring out what George Washington or Alexander Hamilton in their hand were saying was an investigative exercise, was a way to decipher real words that were down there, but kind of blurry. And that reminded me of my lyricals, and I don't think they gave me the idea to go and write everything down in class, but certainly it was two worlds that were similar. And I love being in that dark room deciphering those words because I didn't have to listen to anybody. And I was figuring out the same kind of puzzles I did when I was translating my notes.
We have an email from a listener. They ask, do you have problems with, is it tinnitus? tinnitus, yes. And they ask, if so, how do you deal with it?
Yes, I do. I have, these are what I call my locusts. They are the sounds that many partially deaf and deaf people hear in their ear. Some people think it's the efferent fibers, the nerves which bring the, that reinforce the sound that you hear, that, that travel from the brain to the ear, but they're not quite sure. And I hear those locusts all the time. When you wear hearing aids, it diminishes the sound, and it's much more easy to deal with. There was a point where I struggled quite a bit with them. They brought me to tears early on, but slowly I began to cope with that problem, as I imagine Beethoven did and the French actress Emmanuelle Labouhi did. But it's a real problem.
The you eventually got a great job with an international law firm. It was painful to read about your struggles, though, there, because as you said earlier, when the real world sets in, it's quite different. And it the stress of your struggle eventually made you quite sick.
That's right. Well, it's a fast-moving world, and as you know, mm-hmm. Particularly in a major law firm like mine, Debevoise & Plimpton, which is one of the leading law firms in the country. They're in the news today because Mary Jo White and another lawyer at the firm are together going to be the top two people at the SEC. And it's a world of a great minds, I would say. I don't know how I think I got in the back door, perhaps. but from the very first day, I had problems. The whoosh of the air conditioners and the heating kind of wipes out whatever much of the sound that you have left. And I remember when a partner asked me if I had any such bands, I thought he was talking about securities or shares of clients. And I said no. And then I said it was 12:30. I've got a lunch appointment with Bob Good. And he said, I thought you said you had no lunch plans. Those were my such bands. So it started right off on the wrong foot. So coping with that and translating my notes at night and trying to keep up in negotiations led to a lot of confusion and ultimately to ulcers and medicines like Valium to calm me down and then probenthine to take the liquids out of the system and, I don't know, Jeyusil to calm the stomach and then coffee to wake up again. And it was a terrible cycle of medication and activation.
And you were working 15 hours a day.
Yeah, at least, I would say. Not on the weekends, perhaps. On the weekends, I'd come in at 10 o'clock. And in translating all those notes and looking into documents, thinking maybe the secrets were in those documents, all these people were so good with their lyricals, and I wasn't. I spent a lot of time trying to prepare for the next day by reading and going over my notes. But, of course, you can't plan for the words that are going to be spoken. So it was a very difficult time.
Socially, you managed okay, and that people really seemed to like you. We talked about that earlier at Andover at the law firm, and an old girlfriend you met many years later, and after you got your hearing aid, said, "Don't change, Jerry." And she believed that you would have been someone else without the hearing loss. She said that you had gained more than you had missed. And I wondered if you could talk about that and how you feel about that.
Well, I think she thought there was a certain mystery about me because of the way I was, not connecting much of the time to what people were saying. I remember we went to a movie together. It was called Lady and the Tramp. It was a cartoon. You can never understand cartoons because the lips... the mouths move up and down, the lips don't move. And so I said, "What's going on?" I needed help in understanding the complexities of the Lady and the Tramp. I think at one point she said, I heard her say, "What the cows are saying," and she said, "Cows, there are no cows in this movie." And she had said, "What the characters are saying." So she thought, I think there was a bit of mystery about me, and I think she also thought once I had the problem solved, of course you don't solve it, hearing aids don't work that well, that I shouldn't let it go to my head, that I should remain just as much of a mysterious character as
I was.
Oh, okay. I think that's what she meant.
Okay. Beth in Clintonville, you're on the air with Jerry Sherry. Welcome to the show, Beth.
Hi. Let me get off speaker.
Hello, I missed your name. I'm sorry.
Okay, I have a question for you.
Her name's Beth, Jerry.
Beth, B-E-T-H?
Yes.
Okay, hi, Beth.
Hi, I just have a question for you, and I'll take it up. Once I ask the question, I'll just listen to you off off air. Do you have any opinions one way or the other about cochlear implants, and are they any, in your situation, would they have been effective for somebody as an adult versus a younger person, like a child? And I'll take that off the air.
Right.
Thanks.
Nice.
Okay.
Jerry?
So should I answer this question now?
Sure.
Okay. I think that cochlear implants are a big help for people who have lost their hearing after they have learned spoken language, because they do manage to bring back the signals of speech. They bypass the hearing cells in the ear and go directly to the nerve. So it's a complex exercise. And the sounds, I've never had an implant, but the sounds that they hear are not really, they don't at first at least sound like speech, but I think the brain can reformulate them so that they approximate it. So it brings people who become profoundly deaf back into the hearing world, and with lots of therapy, they can manage, although it's a struggle. I hear too well for cochlear implants. You have to be, I think, profoundly deaf at all frequencies in order, or severely profoundly deaf at all frequencies, low and high, in order to qualify for them.
Go ahead.
As children, I think, shall I go on?
Yes, please.
As to babies, I have a question I don't know the answer to. They're starting to implant very young babies right away, and these are babies, of course, who have never had spoken language, and I wonder whether this is the right solution for them, how much they're going to be able to capture speech. Some can, but can most? I don't know, and I do know that a profoundly deaf child will immediately turn to his hands and eyes and arms to communicate in sign language, and of course can become thoroughly fluent in that language in a smaller world. So the question is, do you want the child to be in a smaller world and to be able to fully express himself, or do you want the child to struggle to be in the world of the hearing? And I don't propose an answer to that question, but it's a difficult one.
You do talk about how people should choose their own language. You devoted a chapter to Helen Keller, for example, and that idea of letting the person choose.
Yes, I think people should have the language they need. Helen Keller, of course, was blind and deaf and then was forced to try to learn how to speak, and she fingerspelled when actually as a child her own language was sign. She had home sign language that she spoke with her family, and she got quite good at it. But because the world was thoroughly oralist then, they wanted Anne to learn how to fingerspell and to try to speak and to use her as an example for the deaf people who could see. And when Anne wrote about the world, she had no memory of colors or of sounds. She wrote very well about colors and sounds, but she really had no idea what she was writing. So she was really expressing the ideas of others, and others were helping her do that. I think that for people like me who are partially deaf, our language is really kind of lyrical, but we are in the hearing world, and we need to be able to communicate as well as we can. The answer for us is hearing aids. And as I said, the answer for older people who have language and lose their hearing may be cochlear implants to keep them in the communicative world. After all, language is what distinguishes us as creatures from the other creatures on Earth, i.e. human beings, and without that language, to a great extent, we lose our own humanity.
My guest is Gerald Shea. He's the author of a new memoir. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. Coming up, we're going to be joined by an audiologist at the Columbus Speech and Hearing Center, Dr. Lisa Wolf. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Come competing budgets battle in Congress, and the president reaches out for a grand bargain. Another Bush may have plans for the presidency. Carl Levin plans to retire. And as Mark Sanford stands for Congress, former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer joins us on Second Chances in American Political Life. I'm Neil Conan, Ken Rudin, the political junkie. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides continues with Wellness Wednesday, where we'll hear about the phenomenon of physician burnout and what it means for you and your doctor. Join us for Wellness Wednesday from 11 till noon. And it's 28 degrees. Expect some light snow showers this afternoon, less than half an inch of accumulation. There's also a chance of snow for tonight, a low of 22. Mostly sunny, warming up to a high of 40 on Thursday. And partly sunny with a high of 51 on Friday. Support comes from OSU's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can limit the effects of a traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey, and how to opt out of the study are at protectiii.com. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about the story of Gerald Shea. He has a new memoir out. It's called Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. Jerry is still with us. Joining us now, though, is Dr. Lisa Wolf. She's from the Columbus Speech and Hearing Center. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
So, Lisa, what are the odds that someone like Jerry Shea could go that long without getting tested nowadays?
Well, it certainly would be more unlikely today than it would have been back when Jerry was young. Things that we have in place now that are a little different than then are we do hearing screenings in kindergarten and first grade, like he described in the book. But then again, every other year, there are hearing screenings being completed in the school. So we try to really stay on top of those things so that if there is an issue, we can catch it as soon as possible. Additionally, now this is a little different than his specific situation, but at this point in the state of Ohio and in most states, babies are screened. Their hearing is screened before they leave the hospital at birth. So if there's an issue from birth, we're catching those things much sooner than we used to as well.
Right. Yep. I think it's a new world today, and it's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Still, of course, sometimes that screening leads to implantation of the child, which is the question I just discussed, mm-hmm. which I have questions about.
And that is a controversy in the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a very complex discussion. Certainly, there are benefits for children who receive implants at a very young age as far as learning spoken language. Many of them do develop pretty typical speech and language skills. But additionally, you know, sometimes the correct option for them is to use sign language. It's really a decision that each family makes, and there's not a right or a wrong answer.
If you'd like to our listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation, have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the website and check out, put your question or comment there.
Lisa's an audiologist. If I can talk about hearing aids for a second.
Absolutely.
I remember when I first got hearing aids, they, as Lisa well knows, they make sounds louder, but they're still a blur. You still have your lyricals, but they're less complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But the most beautiful thing for me about hearing aids once was when I was I put them on for the first time on a Friday evening alone. I'd used them at the office, but I was alone out in the field. It was a summer night. I had my Friday night gin and tonic in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I wasn't alone. And my hearing aids were in my glasses at that time. They were good at high-frequency sounds. And I put them on, and suddenly I heard tens of thousands of crickets in the field, and I turned around listening to them, and it was a beautiful sound that my hearing aids gave me. It was a sound of childhood, a sound that I hadn't heard since I was 6 years old. Sort of like Proust's Madeleine, except that Proust could always taste his Madeleine as he was growing up. My crickets had gone. They brought me also the birds, the rainfall, the footsteps, the breath, the wind, the water. What Kenneth Graham, who wrote The Wind in the Willows, calls the merry bubble and joy of life as a young child. And that was a magic moment for me.
Lisa Wolf, is that something when people do are fitted with something, mm-hmm. a hearing aid or whatever it is that they're being treated for their hearing, is there some, what is the reaction when mm-hmm. they can start hearing? What have you learned from that?
Well, certainly it's a little different for each person.
Right.
But most people tend to have more hearing loss in the higher frequencies than the low frequencies, just like Jerry describes about his own hearing loss. And so there are often a range of sounds that people are unaware that they've been missing for a period of time. Many of the things that he described, environmental sounds, water running, the sound of your feet on the floor creaking. Sometimes people come in after having tried hearing aids for a couple of weeks and describe, you know, I had no idea that my refrigerator made that sound or that there was an issue with my car that I wasn't able to hear that it was making that sound. So there certainly are some sounds, I think, that, you know, for most people, hearing changes very gradually. And obviously, Jerry, your situation was different. But because hearing tends to change so gradually for adults with an age-related type of hearing loss, it's hard to notice the difference that those sounds are kind of slowly fading into the background.
Right. Well, the magic for me was it really brought back my childhood. And
the
second part of the magic of hearing aids, they're helpful in words. They enabled me to practice law, if I think I fair to say, for another 20 years. But was the sound of music that they brought. I mean, all those violins and piccolos and flutes had been gone all my life, or virtually all my life. And suddenly, especially with the music button you have in your hearing aids, they brought back, which helped with music but not with words, they brought back all those high sounds. So the violins and the flutes and the strings took over the melody from the low sounds that I heard, and suddenly I could appreciate concerts and symphonies for what they really were. As I say in the book, Peter rivals the wolf in Prokofiev, and there too, in the world of music, I become a child again, because I can hear both Peter and the wolf with equal clarity.
When you were diagnosed, it was because you had a screening for a new job.
Well, finally, yeah. I changed jobs. I left the firm and went to work for Mobile Corporation, and their chairman had become deaf, and they decided to have everyone get a hearing test. So I went to see the audiologist at Mobile and as part of their medical, and she rang a bunch of tones, 20 tones, and I pressed 5. And I joked with her before. I told her my hearing was keen because loud noises bothered me, which is a key symptom of deafness. And I said that I love music and I love to sing. So when I stepped out of the booth, she said, "Okay, where are your hearing days?" And I know she meant where are your hearing aids? And so I failed the test miserably. But for a whole year, I did nothing, Lisa, absolutely nothing. I simply kept going to meetings, getting into trouble, falling behind, getting criticized. I would hear that indirectly. And finally, a year later, went up to Massachusetts, where the hearing doctor thought that I had a brain tumor because the significant loss seemed so sudden, and I had such a full professional life. And he suggested I go see a neurologist down in New York right as soon as I got back on Monday. He said this was a Friday. But I decided instead to go up to Columbia P&S and see their chief of ENT, who figured out the problem, whose audiologist had looked at it, and we talked at length, and he basically took me through where I was, what my condition was, and how long it probably had lasted. That was also a moving moment in my life.
To accept what it was.
I'm sorry?
To accept what it was.
To accept what it was, to think about all that I had missed, to think about, you know, Proust's work is called remembrance of things past. Some people call it in search of lost time. At that moment, I guess I was thinking about all the time and all the words that I had lost for so long. But at the same time, I was hopeful that they would come back. I asked the doctor whether these hearing aids would work, and he said, well, try them out and you'll see. And I know that they work for music and the sounds of nature wonderfully, and that they do help me with words to the extent that they enabled me to stay in the game, to stay in law practice for so much longer.
Is that the only hearing aid you've ever, is that the only style you've ever had? Have you used and tried other styles of hearing aids?
Oh, the glasses are gone, long since gone. Okay. I get new hearing aids about every 4 years. As you mentioned earlier, I live in Paris, and the French are very good about that. The cost of hearing aids is substantial. As Lisa knows, they can cost as much as, I don't know, $5,000 or $6,000. Mm-hmm. I forget the precise number, but the cost of those hearing aids is covered by French social insurance. It's supplementary insurance, but it's inexpensive and everybody has it. So unlike in the United States, those costs are covered. So I get hearing aids about every 4 or 5 years when the others wear out and when the technology improves, although the improvements I find are relatively slight.
Bill in Dublin, you're on the air with Dr. Lisa Wolf of the Columbus Speech and Hearing Center and also Gerald Shea, author of Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Thank you. Hey, my son is a heavy metal musician, and I've been trying...
I'm sorry, what, Bill? Is a...
Heavy metal musician?
Heavy metal, right, okay.
Yeah, and I've been to a couple of his concerts, and it's not good for your ears. But I've been trying to convince him to wear earplugs. Do you have any suggestions how I could get him to do that?
Lisa?
Sure, I'd be happy to answer that question. Certainly, that type of music, or really any live music, is generally loud enough that it could potentially damage hearing, especially, you know, repeated exposure to noise at that level. I know several musicians who are patients of mine who use hearing protection always at practice and decide not to use it for a performance. That's, you know, one way that they're able to protect their ears most of the time, but still feel as though, you know, they're able to hear things the way they'd like to for a performance. But there are also special custom-made earplugs that can be used for performances that are made with filters specifically for music so that it doesn't distort the signal, so that sounds still come through with a good quality, just simply at a lower volume. So there are things that can be done.
Yes, and Bill, I think I would stress to your son that if he doesn't protect his ears, he may not be a musician all his life. It may be a time when words are very important to him professionally, and of course they're always important personally. And if he loses that power to communicate with other people easily, it's going to have a terrible effect on how he feels about himself and how he makes his way in life.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Bill, for that call.
All right. Thanks for the information.
You bet. Take care. Wallace in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome, Wallace.
Yes, I'm here.
Hi.
Hello, Wallace.
Yes, I have this question for you, Mr. Shea. Have you ever watched Charlie Chaplin or any silent movies? And if you did they all of a sudden make sense to you? Because they were geared, of course, without the sound.
Yes.
Is my question clear?
And the question is, did they make sense to me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, I love silent movies because, in fact, I think I'm pretty quick at figuring out what's going on or what's going to happen in silent movies because they're so visual. I don't think people really make up in other senses what they lose in a specific sense. I think that's sort of been disproven. But I think your awareness is heightened. So in my case, your mind is moving very quickly. And to watch a silent movie for me is a great joy.
Lisa, and by the way, thank you, Wallace, for that call. Lisa, Jerry described lots of common signs of hearing loss in his book, which makes the book so rich.
Loss of what?
I was mentioning to Lisa that you talked a lot about common signs of hearing loss in your book, which
yeah.
made the book richer for that. And I was wondering if, Lisa, you could talk about what are the most common signs that people should look for?
Certainly, if you feel as though you're asking for repetition frequently, having a hard time understanding others in conversation, that's a pretty good indication. Oftentimes, people, especially with a higher frequency type of hearing loss, people will feel as though they hear well in a one-on-one conversation, but in a larger group or if there's more background noise, it becomes much more difficult to kind of pick out what you're trying to listen to in background noise. Those are things that people frequently describe to me. Also, I guess if a family member has expressed concern.
Well, my kid
noticed,
always tells me okay. I can't hear, so does that count?
Perhaps.
And, yeah, don't forget those loud noises that yes. are very disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And the ringing in the ears, too, is a key sign,
yes.
I think.
And I haven't been tested for years for my hearing, and as I mentioned, my child thinks I should be. But beyond that, most of us aren't tested for our hearing mm-hmm. until it becomes something really, really overt.
That's right.
What is your recommendation, Lisa, for how often an adult should be tested?
Well, certainly I think anytime there is a concern that there's an issue with hearing, that would be a good time kind of to get a baseline hearing test at the very least. I mean, the average in America, the average length of time that a person waits when they believe between the time that they believe they have an issue with their hearing and when they initially have a hearing test or seek help is 7 years. That's a pretty long time. I know that sometimes, like at a physical with a physician, they will do a hearing screening or that kind of thing, but it's not a bad idea just to get a baseline hearing test. And then if everything is normal, maybe we recheck it, you know, a couple of years down the road.
Okay. Well, yep. Dr. Lisa Wolf, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Sure, thanks.
Dr. Lisa Wolf, she's an audiologist at the Columbus Speech and Hearing Center. And Jerry Shea, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ann. It was a great pleasure.
Gerald Shea, he's the author of Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.